The Preludes, Book One, Text. There is blushing in this gentle breeze, a visitant that while it fans my cheek, doth seem half conscious of the joy it brings from the green fields and from yon azure sky. Whatever its mission, the soft breeze can come to none more grateful than to me escaped from the vast city where I long had find a discontented sojourner now free. Free as a bird to settle where I will, what dwelling shall receive me in what well? Shall be my harbor underneath what grove? Shall I take up my home and what clear stream? Shall with its murmur lull me into rest? The earth is all before me with a heart. Joyous nor sacred at its own liberty, I look about and sought the chosen guide. Be nothing better than a wandering cloud, I cannot miss my way, I breathe again. Trances of thought and mountings of the mind come first upon me, it is second off. That burden of my own unnatural self, the heavy weight of many a weary day, not mine and such as were not made for me. Long months of peace, if such bold word accord with my promise of human life. Long moments of ease and undisturbed delight are mine in prospect, whether shall I turn by road or pathway or thought trackless field, of hill or down, or shall some floating things up to the river point out my course. 1 to 30. Now I'm going to read its paraphrase. The mild breeze is a gift from heaven to me. It is a holy visitor from heaven, which, while it cares at my cheek, seems to be aware of the joy that it brings for me from the blue sky and the green fields. Whatever may be its purpose, this mild breeze cannot be more cheering to anybody else than to me. I have just come out of that great city of London, where I lived for a long time is an unhappy state. Now I am free and can settle down wherever I like. Now which spot will be my abode? In which valley should I find shelter? Under which grove should I set my home? Which clear stream will soothe me into rest and sleep with its murmuring sound? The whole earth is wide open before me. With a heart full of joy, I can look round myself and am not afraid of the newly acquired freedom. I can now not miss my way, even I choose to follow a sailing cloud as my guide. Once again, I can breathe like a free man. Lofty ideas and exalted flights of imagination crowd my mind, but my mind, now it relieved of the burden of its unnatural self, of the heavy weight of deep discontentment and oppressed me for a long time. In fact, this deep discontentment that oppressed me for a long time, in fact, this burden was unusual to me. I can now foresee long time of peace and uninterrupted happiness without knowing if our future life can at all fulfill such great expectations. Which direction shall I like? Which road shall I follow? Regular road or pathless field? Shall I know my way by some chance object on the river? Second stanza. Text. Dear liberty, yet what would it avail but for a gift that consecrates the joy? For I, me thought, while the sweet breath of heaven was blowing on my body, felt within a correspondent breeze that gently moved with quickening virtue, but is now become a tempest, redundant energy, vexing its own creation thanks to both and their congenial powers that while they join in breaking off a long continued frost, bring with them vernal promises, the hope of active days horsed on by flying hours, days of sweet leisure taxed with patient thought, abstruse not wanting punctual service high, matins and vespers of harmonious verse. So now I'm going to read the paraphrase of the stanza number 2. No doubt, liberty is dear to me. Yet this liberty will be the title, will be of little use if it is not accompanied with greater gift that renders this joy sacred. It appeared to me that when the gentle breeze of heaven was blowing on my body, I felt that a similar breeze of poetic inspiration was blowing within my heart. The breeze moved gently at first, but gradually it gained speed till it has now grown into a tempest, having so much of superfluous energy that it is causing trouble to its own source. I am thankful to both these, the external breezes and internal breezes, with their congenial powers to dispel the long continued frost. With them has come a bright promise of spring, filling me with a great hope of days of creative activity. That period will really be a period of sweet leisure, burdened with deep philosophical meditations and not without the high and regular service of writing poetry of a lofty and sublime under the morning or the evening. Line number 46 to 58, stanza number 3. Thus far, O friend, did I not use to make a present joy the matter of a song, pour forth that day my soul in measured strains that would not be forgotten, and there are here recorded to the open fields I told a prophecy, poetic numbers came spontaneously to cloth in priestly robe, a renovated spirit singled out such hope as mine for holy services. My own voice cheered me, and for more, the mind's internal echo of the imperfect sound, to both I listened, drawing from them both a cheerful confidence in things calm. Stanza number 3, paraphrase. Oh my friend, here he addresses to Coleridge, I have not been in the habit of turning an immediate joy into a subject of writing a poem. Hitherto I have only expressed the deepest feelings of my heart in harmonious verses which could never be forgotten by me, and so I recorded them here. I predicted like a prophet and addressed myself to the meadows. Verses came to me naturally and effortlessly, giving expression in a spiritual graph to a refreshed and revitalized spirit, which, so I hoped, was suitable for writing poetry of spiritual exaltation. My own voice cheered me up, and more than that, I was cheered by the internal echo of the imperfect sound of my voice. I listened to both my voice and the echo of this voice in my mind, and drew from both an optimistic confidence in the safe of things to come. Line 59-100, stanza number 4, text. Content and not unwilling now to give a respite to this passion I placed on, which brisk and eager steps and came at length to a green sandy place where down I sat, beneath a tree, slackening my thoughts by choice and settling into gentler happiness. It was autumn and a clear and flashy day, with warmth as much as needed from a sun. 2 hours declined towards the west a day, with silver clouds and sunshine on the grass, and in the sheltered and the sheltering grove a perfect stillness. Many were the thoughts encouraged and dismissed, till choice was made of a known veil, whither my feet should turn, nor terrace till I had reached the very door of the one cottage which methought I saw. No picture of mere memory ever looked so fair, while open it fancied seen. I gazed with growing love, a higher power than fancy gave assurance of some work, of glory there forthwith to be begun, perhaps too there performed. Thus long I mused, nor ever lost sight of what I mused upon, save when amid and stately grove of oaks, now here, now there, an acorn from its cup dislodged through sheer leaves rustled o'er at once, to the bare earth dropped with a startling sound. From that soft couch I rose not till the sun had almost touched the horizon, casting then a backward glance upon the curling cloud of city smoke by distance ruralized, keen as a torrent or a fugitive, but as a pilgrim resolute I took. Even with the chance equipment of that hour, the road that pointed toward the chosen well, it was a splendid evening, and my soul once more made trial of her strength, nor lagged. Aeolian visitations, but the half was soon refroided and banded host of harmony dispersed in staggering sounds, and lastly utter silence, be it so. Why think of anything but present good, so like homebound laborer I pursued my way beneath the mellowing sun that said mild influence, nor left in my wand wish again to bend the Sabbath of that time to a servile yoke, what need of many words. A pleasant loitering journey through 3 days continued brought me to my hermitage. I spare to tell of what ensued the life in common things, the endless store of things. Rare, or at least so seeming every day, found all about me in one neighborhood, the self-congratulation and from morn to night unbroken cheerfulness serene, but speedily an earnest longing rose to brace myself to some determined aim, reading or thinking, either to lay off new stores or rescue from decay the old. But by timely interference, and therewith came hope still higher, that with outward life I might endure some airy fantasies that had begun floating, that have been floating loose about 4 years, and to such beings temporarily deal forth the many feelings that oppressed my heart, that hope hath been discouraged, welcome light dawns from the east, but dawns to disappear, and mock me with a sky that ripens not into a steady morning, if my mind, remembering the bold promise of the past, would gladly grapple with some noble theme. Vain is her wish, wherever she turns she finds impediments from day to day renowned. Now, it's a paraphrase, stanza number 4. I was well contented and felt inclined to give everything space to my creative urge for writing poetry. I moved on with quick and eager steps, and at last reached a green shadowy place where I sat down under a tree, willingly relaxing my thoughts and settling into a mood of calm happiness. It was a calm and sheer day of autumn. To the sun which had gone down towards the west 2 hours ago was giving out the desired degree of warmth. There were silvery clouds, and the grass was looking bright and sunrays. An absolute calm prevailed in the grove that was sheltering from the sun by tall trees and offered shelter to others, First, I thought of several places for my shelter, but these places were dismissed after some consideration. Finally, a known valley was selected by me. I continued moving till I reached the very door of one particular cottage, which seemed familiar to me. No other mental picture ever looked so attractive as the picture of this cottage. As I gazed upon that scene of my imagination with increasing fascination, some more divine or nobler power than fancy spoke with assurance to my soul that I would begin some exalted work of glory at that place. While living in this cottage, and perhaps would also be able to accomplish this great task there, thus for a long time I was engrossed in my thoughts without losing sight of the subject of my reflections. Except when an acorn, freed from its cough, fell down rustling through the dry leaves amid and the majestic grove of oak tree, or when all of a sudden dropped to a bare ground, startling me out of my deep thought. From that soft couch or grass I did not rise and settle down till the sun was about to set. Then I threw a backward glance upon the rising city smoke, presenting before me a rural charm as the smoke was seen from a distance. I felt as enthusiastic as one who runs away from duty or as one who runs away from danger. But I was as determined to go to my destination as a pilgrim and took the road to the valley chosen by me. Although I had very little equipment at that time except that which by chance I had got with me, it was a lovely evening, and once again my soul began to test its own power and ability. My soul was not without inspiration that seemed to play upon my soul as wind plays on the Aeolian harp. But soon the inspiration grew weaker, the inspiration failed to produce a harmonious pattern. The notes grew weaker and fainter and finally died away. There was absolute silence and I uttered, "Be it so," I began to ponder. Why should I think of anything except the immediate joy? Stanza number 4, text. And now it would content me to yield off those lofty hopes afile for present gifts of humbler industry. But oh dear friend, the poet, gentle creature as he is, hath like the lover his unruly times. He speeds when he is neither sick nor well, though no distress be near him but his own. On manageable thoughts his mind best pleased, while she as duteous as the mother dove. She is brooding, life's not always to that end, but like the innocent bird hath groanings on that drive for as an in trouble though the groves. With me is now such passion to be blamed no otherwise that as it lasts too long. Its paraphrase, line 132 to 145. Now I shall be contented if I give up my lofty hopes for the present to engage myself with some modest type of work. But my dear friend, a gentle creature as the poet is, he experiences moments when he is unable to control his passions and when he is neither ill nor well. At such time there is nothing to agitate him except his own uncontrolled passion. The poet's mind is pleasant most when it is lost in deep meditation upon some chosen subject. Thus as the mother dove is the happiest when it broods its eggs with loving care. But the poet's mind does not stick to this function for long for it. It goaded out for itself by inspiration, then like the dove which feels tempted to fly through the groves as if it were in trouble. At present I am under the spell of such an emotional stress. There is nothing wrong about this, but I am blaming it because this mood is lasting rather too long. Stanza number 5, line 46 to line 185. When as becomes a man who would prepare for such an arduous work, I throw myself, make rigorous inquisition. The report is often cheering, for I neither seem to lack that first great gift, the vital soul, nor general truths, which are themselves a sort of element and agents under powers, subordinate helpers of the living mind. Nor am I naked of external things, forms, images, nor numerous other aids. Of less regard, though own perhaps with toil, and needful to build up a poet's praise, time, place, and manners do I seek, and these are found in plenteous store, but nowhere such as may be singled out with steady choice. No little band of yet remembered names, whom I in perfect confidence might hope to summon back from the lonesome banishment and make them dwellers in the hearts of men. Now living, or to live in future years, sometimes the ambitious power of choice mistaking, proud spring tide swelling for a regular sea, will settle on some British theme, some old romantic tale by Milton left unsung, more often turning to some gentle place. Within the groves of silvery I peep to shepherd swains, or seated harp in hand amid reposing nights by riverside, or fountain listen to the grave reports of dire enchantments faced and overcome by the strong mind, and tales of warlike feats where spear encountered spear and sword with sword fought as if conscious of the blazonry that the still before slow glorious was the strife, whence inspiration for a song that winds through ever-changing scenes of votive quest. Wrongs of redress, harmonious tribute paid to patient courage and unblemished truth. To firm devotion, zeal unquenchable, and Christian meekness, hallowing faithful loves. Sometimes most sternly moved, I would relate a vanquished Mithridates northward past, and hidden in the cloud of years became Odin, the father of the race by whom perished the Roman Empire, how the friends, and followers of Sartorius out of Spain, flying, found shelter in the fortunate Isles, and left their usage, their arts and laws to disappear by a slow, gradual death, to dwindle and to perish one by one, starved in those narrow bounds, but not the soul of liberty which 1500 years survived when the European came, with skill and power that might not be withstood, did like a pestilence maintain its hold, and wasted down by glorious death that race of natural heroes, or I would record how in tyrannic times some high souls man, unnamed among the chronicles of kings, suffered in silence for truth's sake, or tell how that one Frenchman, though continued force of meditation on the inhuman deeds of those who conquered first the Indian Isles, went singles in this ministry across the ocean, not to comfort the oppressed, but like the thirsty wind to roam about, withering or oppressor, now Gustavus sought help at his need in Dalecrolius mines. How Wallace fought for Scotland, left the name, or Wallace to be found like a wild flower all over his dear country, left the deeds of Wallace like a familiar ghost to people the steep rocks and river banks, her natural sanctuaries with local soul of independence and stern liberty. Sometimes it suits me better to invent a tale from my own heart, more near akin to my own passions and habitual thoughts, some variegated story in the main. Lofty, but the unsubstantial structure melts before the very sound that brightens it, mist into air dissolving, then a whiz. My last and favorite aspiration mounts with earning towards some philosophic song of truth that cherishes our daily life. With meditations passionate from deep, recresses in man's heart, immortal words thoughtfully fitted to Orphean lyre. But from the awful burden I full soon take refuse that beguile myself with trust, that my lower years will bring a riper mind and clearer insight, thus my days are passed in contradiction with no skill to part. Vague longing happily bred by want of power from the paramount impulse not to be withstood, a timorous capacity from prudence, from the circumspection, infinite delay. Humility and the modest awe themselves betray me, serving often for a cloak to a more subtle selfishness that now locks every function of in a blank reverse, now dupes me, trusting to an anxious eye that with intrusive restlessness, beast of simplicity and self-presented truth, better far than this to stray about voluptuously through fields and rural works. Ask no record of the hours resigned to vacant music, unreproved neglect of all things and deliberate holiday. Far better never to have heard the name of zeal and just ambition than to live baffled and flogged by a mind that every hour turns recurrent to her task, takes heart again, then feels immediately some hollow thought hang like an interdict upon her lobes. This is my lot, for either still I find some imperfection in the chosen theme, or she of absolute accomplishment, much wanting, so much wanting in myself, that I recoil and droop and seek repose. In listlessness from vain prospectivity, unprofitably traveling toward the grave, like a false steward who hath much received and renders nothing back. Now I'm going to read its paraphrase. When it is necessary for a person who prepares himself to accomplish such a difficult task, I subject myself to severe self-analysis. I find the results most encouraging. I do not seem to be lacking either in the first great gift, that of a creative and organic sensibility, or the power of understanding universal truth, which are themselves like the agents or mediaries to the living soul to create. I'm also not lacking in the external resources like funds, images, and many other things of lesser importance, but these are very much necessary for the fame of the poet, and they are acquired with the hard intellectual labor. I intend to seek a more appropriate time, place, and manners which are available in abundance, but none of them provide a firm choice. I remember a large group of names which I can confidentially call back to my mind from oblivion and make them like again in the hearts of people of my own times and those of future times. Sometimes my ambition of choice of a proper theme leads me to mistake a short-lived unrush of poetic inspiration as a steady source of profound creative activity. This inspiration makes me think of a theme relating to Britain, a romantic tale which perhaps Milton left unsung. Very often my mind turns to some gentle theme of chivalry, and I think of composing pastoral poems to please the ears of shepherds, or sometimes I feel like sitting down with a harp in my hand by the side of a river or a fountain where nights are relaxing, and listening to stories of enchantments which the brave relaxing and listening of stories which the brave knights faced and overcome. I may also listen there to the tales of brave martial deeds where spears and swords clashed together and the weapons clashed with one another so boldly that it seemed that they were quite aware of the accounts of glory, that heroic tradition of knights engraved on the shields. This made their struggle great and glorious. I derived inspiration of writing a poem from such stories, a poem narrating the gallant and determined quest of opportunities by warrior of various places to redress the wrongs and also to pay a tribute in a lyrical language to the people of preserving courage and endurance, of pure truth and firm loyalties, of unending enthusiasm to serve a right cause and a Christian humility lending sacred touch to faithful love. Sometimes stirred to ponder over a more serious subject, I would like to narrate the story of Roman general Mithridates, who moved towards the north after his defeat and after spending a number of years in obscurity, reappeared as Odin, whose race ultimately became the cause of the downfall of the Roman Empire. Or I would prefer to describe how the friends and followers of Sertorius in the Roman general who fled from Spain to take shelter in the Fortunate Islands, and how their customs, arts, and their laws given up by them gradually wasted away slowly and ultimately died and disappeared due to prolonged disuse of these small islands. But the spirit of liberty never died out and remained alive in them for as long as 1500 years, when the Europeans came there with their irresistible power and skill. That spirit of freedom maintained its hold on this race of natural heroes like some deadly disease, and thus they died a glorious death. Or I would relate the story of the times when despotic kings ruled some heroic soul, never mentioned in the historical records of the Byzantine kings, and emperors embraced troubles and suffering silently for the sake of truth. Or I would tell how that Frenchman Dominique de Gorgias, who under the pressure of long meditation on the inhuman actions of those Spaniards who were the first to conquer the Indian Isles, voyaged all alone across the sea to carry out his solemn task. His intention was not merely to confront the victims of a persecution, but to wander about like a hot and thirsty wind to bring death and disaster to the oppressors. Or I would like to narrate how Gustavus I, the king of Sweden, aspiring to free his country from Danish rule, sought help to live in disguise in the mining district of Dalecarlia. Or how Wallace fought for the liberty of Scotland and left his name and fame forwarding his country, just like wildflowers growing everywhere, and how his brave deeds like invisible spirit haunted every part of the country with its steepy rocks and river banks, natural sanctuaries provided by nature herself to inspire the inhabitants with an uncompromising spirit of liberty. Sometimes it is more suitable to me to narrate a story of my own imaginative creation, which is more closely related to my intense feelings and habitual thinking. It might be a story consisting of diverse elements but with an exalted tone, but the great intensity of my poetic passion melts the vague structure of such a story, just as mist melts away with the appearance of such rays of rising sun. Then I feel a passionate urge arising in my soul, namely that of writing a lofty philosophical poem dealing with some great truth which gives strength and sustenance to our day-to-day life. Such a lofty poem of undying fame rises from the very depth of the human soul after deep meditations. It is as sublime as the music of Orpheus playing on his lyre. But very soon I recoil from the thought of undertaking such an arduous task, and console myself with a fond hope that my advancing years will bestow upon me a mature power of thinking and a deeper wisdom to compose a lofty poem. Thus I pass my days in contradictory thoughts. I seem to lack the power of distinguishing desires from irresistible poetic urges without any definite plan for creation. I'm hesitant to make a choice, and this hesitation may be due to my lack of confidence or to my desire to be very wise and cautious, to run any risk, and all this bring about an endless delay. I've been misled by my humility and fear arising out of modesty. This often serves the purpose of some kind of cover for subtle kind of selfishness in me that has at one time wholly paralyzed by poetic talents, and at some other time it deceives me by intruding upon me and putting off the simplicity of style and a truth which offers itself to me for clear expression. Instead of suffering like this, it would be better for me to roam about over the fields and village pathways, deriving only sensuous pleasures from the beauty of nature, keeping no records of time spent on musing purposelessly and enjoying a purposeful leisure. I feel it would be far better for me to forget zeal or ambition rather than to live in an unimaginable agony of a confused and distracted mind that every hour turns cowardly away from its task, a mind that at one moment takes courage and at the next moment feels dejected due to some hollow thought acting as a deterrent to all long-cherished hopes. This is my unhappy condition, that either I find some drawbacks in my chosen theme or I find myself so much lacking in perfection to deal with my chosen theme that I recoil from my task, feel dejection, lethargy and indolence, seeking an escape from the futile distractions of my mind. So I find myself heading towards the grave without performing an useful deed, like an unfaithful caretaker of an estate who has received a lot from his master but has done nothing substantial to him in return. Line number 270 to 300. Was it for this that one, the fairest of all rivers, loved to blend his murmurs with my north song, and from his alder seats and rocky falls, and from his forts and sallows sent a voice that flowed along my dreams? For this didst thou, O Derwent, winding among the grassy homes where I was looking on, a babe in arms, make ceaseless music that composed my thoughts to more than infant softness giving me, amid the fretful dwelling of mankind, a foretaste, a dim earnest of the calm that nature breathes among the hills and groves, when he had leapt the mountains and received on his smooth breast the shadow of those towers that yet survive a shattered monument of federal survey, the bright blue river passed along the margin of our terrace walk, a tempting playmate whom we dearly loved. Oh, many a time have I, a 5 year child, oh, many a, in a small mile receded from his stream, made one long bathing of a summer's day, basked in the sun and flung and basked again, alternate all summer's day or showered the sandy fields, slipping through flowery groves of yellow ragout, or when rock and hill, the woods and distant skiddos of lofty height, where bronzed with the deepest radiance, stood alone beneath the sky as if I had been born on Indian plains and from my mother's heart, had run about in wantonness to sport a naked savage in the thunder shower. Was it for this condition of my mind that Derwent, the fairest of all rivers, gladly mingled its soft bubbling sound with my Norse song? And from the groves of alder trees growing on its bank, its rocky waterfalls, and from its forts and shallow places sent a voice to blend with my childhood dreams. O Derwent, was it for this that you followed this winding course, the grassy meadows on which I used to cast steady looks as a very young child produced sweet musical sounds for very long without a break to soothe and comfort me with the serenity and gentleness greater than that enjoyed by an infant, and to give me, even in the midst of human beings overburdened with fever and fret of life, an experience rather than advance, a vague anticipatory feeling of such calm and serenity which nature engenders among hills and groves. The river dormant after leaving the mountains and after receiving on its smooth surface the shadow of still surviving towers of Cockermouth Castle, the dilapidated memorial federal power and greatness flowed into the plains along the side of our terrace work. The river was like a tempting companion, and therefore I loved it dearly. When I was 5 years old, I would often spend the whole day of a summer in bathing on a channel, branching off from this river and driving a water mill. I basked in sun and dived into the river alternately. Throughout a summer's day or at some other times, I would run about briskly on the sandy fields, leaping through groups of yellow ragout or when the rock and hill forest and the towering top of Skiddaw turned rich brown. Like bronze by the light of sun, I would stand alone beneath the sky. I would then feel as if I were born in the land of red Indians and had, in a playful mood, run out my mother's hut to play like wild naked boy in the thunder shower. Line number 300 to 320. Text. Fair seed time had my soul, and I grew up, fostered alike by beauty and by fear, much favored in my birthplace and no less in that beloved well to which ere long we were transplanted there where we let loose for sports of wider range ere I had told. 10 birthdays when among the mountain slopes frost and a breath of frosty wind had snapped the last autumnal crocus, it was my joy. With store of springs over my shoulder hung to range the open heights where woodcocks run along the smooth green turf through half the night, scudding away from snare to snare I flied. That anxious vegetation, moon and stars were shining over my head, I was alone and seemed to be troubled to the peace that dwelt among them, sometimes it befell. In these night wanderings that a strong desire overpowered my better reason, and the bird which was the captive of another's toil became my prey, and when the deed was done I heard among the solitary hills low breathings coming after me and sounds undistinguishable motion, steps almost as salient as turf they trod. Now it's paraphrase. My soul had a very fertile environment for the period of its early growth. In this atmosphere I was nursed and brought up by the emotions aroused both by beauty and awe. I was much popular in Cockermouth by my birthplace. I was equally liked in the beloved valley of Eastwaite, to which we were shifted soon afterwards, and where we enjoyed greater freedom to take part in a variety of games. Before I became 10 years of age, when the frost and the chilly wind had sharply beaten in the last autumnal crocus, it gave me immense pleasures to wander with bird snares hanging from my shoulder over the sides of high hills where the woodcocks would run over the green grassy soil. Right up to midnight, I used to run very quickly from one trap to another, observing and working anxiously. All this time the light of the moon and stars shone over my head. I used to be alone and felt that I was a disturbing element for peace prevailing there. Sometimes in the course of this wandering in the nights, a strong desire got the upper hand over my reasoning power. I took hold of a bird which was the reward of the labor of sometimes else. After such unfair deed, I felt that someone with suppressed breath was silently following me, and I also heard sounds of movements which I could not hear distinctly, and also felt footsteps following me as quickly and silently as the grass on which they moved. Line number 326 to 339. Text. Nor when spring had wandered the cultured vale, moved we as plunders where the mother bird had in high places built her laws, though mean our object and inglorious, yet the end was not in ignoble. Oh, when I have hung above the raven's nest by knots of grass and half-inch fissures in the slippery rock, but ill-sustained and almost suspended by the blast that blew main, shouldering the naked crag o'er at that time, while on the perilous ridge I hung alone. With what strange utterance did the loud dry wind blow through my ear? The sky seemed not a sky of earth, and with what motion moved the clouds. We continued our activities unabatedly when the spring brought warmth to the cultivated valley, and then we enjoyed wandering about just like rovers in quest of high places where the mother birds might have built their nest, though our aim was mean. Nature directed us to some nobler end, or when I was hanging precariously above the nest of a raven, supporting myself by holding on the knots of grass and narrow cracks in the slippery rocks, it seemed to me that I was lifted off by the strong wind that blew furiously on the naked rock. At such a time, while I hung alone on the dangerous hillside, the loud dry wind seemed to speak to me in a mysterious voice. The sky also had a strange unearthly appearance, and the clouds appeared to move very mysteriously. Line number 340 to 356. Text. Dust as we are, the immortal spirit grows like harmony in music. There is a dark, inscrutable workmanship that reconciles discordant elements, makes them cling together in one society. How strange that all the terrors, pains, and yearly miseries, regrets, vexations, lassitudes interfused within my mind should ever have borne a part, and that a needful part in making of the calm existence that is mine when I am worthy of myself. Race to the end. Thanks to the means which nature designed to employ, whether her fearless visitings or those that came with loved alarm like hotless light opening the peaceful clouds, or she would use severer interventions, ministry more palatable as best might suit her aim. Now its paraphrase. Although we are only dust and therefore mortal, our immortal soul develops like a harmony in music. Nature possesses a secret and opposite elements, and thus brings them together in one harmonious combination. It's so really strange that all the moods of weariness, all mixed up in my mind, should have played a necessary part to bring about a calm and peaceful existence for me. When I feel nobly in a matter of worthy of myself, I praise this ultimate peace and serenity of my soul. I am also grateful to nature for all the elements employed by her, whether they were her fearless appearances or those that caused some slight and gentle fear which is caused by the harmless light that seems to pass through clouds without disturbing them. It is also possible that nature should use sometimes severer measures to create more tangible effect on the mind of the poet to suit her purpose best. Line number 357 to 400. Once our evening I found a little boat tied a willow tree within a rocky cave, its usual home. Straight I unloosed her chain and stepping in, pushed from the shore, it was an act of stealth, a troubled pleasure, nor without the voice of mountain echoes did my boat move on, leaving behind her still on either side small circles glittering idly in the moon, until they melted all into one track of sparkling light. But now, like one who rows proud of his skill to reach a chosen point, with an unswerving line I fixed my view upon the summit of a craggy ridge, the horizon utmost boundary for above. Was nothing but the stars, but the grey sky. She was an elfin pinnack. Lustily, I dipped my oars into the silent lake. And as I rose upon the stroke, my boat went heaving through the water like a swan. When from behind that craggy steep till then, the horizon bound a huge peak, black and huge, as if with voluntary power, instinct of reared its head, I struck and struck again, and growing still in stature, the green shape towered up between me and the stars, and still, for so it seemed, with purpose of its own and measured motion like a living thing, strode after me with trembling oars. I turned, and through the silent water stole my way back to the covert of the willow tree. There in her mooring place I left my bark, and through the meadows homeward went in grave and serious mood. But after I had seen that spectacle for many days, my brain worked with a dim and undermined sense of unknown modes of being over my thoughts. There hung a darkness, call it solitude or blank desertation, no familiar shapes. Remained no pleasant images of trees or sea or sky, no colors of green fields, but hues and mighty forms they do not live. Like a living man moved slowly through the mind by day, and were a trouble to my dreams. Now, I'm reading its paraphrase. Led by nature, one summer evening, I happened to find little boat tied to willow tree within a rocky cave where it was kept usually. Immediately, I untied the chain and, after getting into the boat, pushed it up the shore. I was obviously an act of theft, and my joy was naturally tingled with anxiety. When the boat moved on, the mountains on both sides echoed with the sound of rowing. On both sides of boat left behind small circles of water gleaming early under moonlight, till all of them were mixed up and turned into a single track of glittering light. But now, like one who proudly rose to reach straight up to destination without deviation, I fixed my eyes on the top of an uneven mountain range which appeared as the farthest boundary on a distant horizon. But there was nothing but grey sky and stars above me. My boat looked like a fairy. I put the oars vigorously into the silent water of the lake, and I rose up after the stroke to propel it. My boat sailed ahead like a swan gliding on the surface of the lake. At times, from behind that uneven range of the high hill, which had to so far seem to me be the boundary of distant horizon, a huge black peak reared its head like a living being with a will and power of its own. I continued to strike or against the water of the lake, but the terrible peak seemed increased in size till its huge stature seemed to stand between me and the stars. I still felt that the awful shape was a living creature which was following me with a deliberate movement, with some fixed purpose of its own. With the oars in my trembling hands, I turned my course and moving silently over the calm surface of the lake, I came back to the shelter of the willow tree. I left the boat at the mooring place and went homeward in a pensive and serious mood through the meadows. But for many days after I had witnessed that spectacle, my mind was perplexed by a vague and strange feeling that there were mysterious forms of life in nature which are beyond the knowledge of human being. Over my thoughts there hung a spiritual darkness that almost wiped out all my previous knowledge. It may be called more mere solitude or a complete vacuum in my mind. I was hardly conscious of my impression of all previously known objects and pleasing sights, that of trees, sea or sky, or the colors of the green fields. But huge and mighty forms that exist not like man haunted my mind during the day and also troubled me in my dreams. Line number 401 to 424. Text: Wisdom and spirit of the universe, thou soul that art the eternity of thought, that givest to forms and images of breath and everlasting motion not in vain. By day or starlight thus from my first dawn, the path of childhood didst thou intervine for me. That passions that build up our human soul, not with the mean and vulgar works of man, but with high objects, with enduring things, with life and nature purifying thus the elements of feeling and of thought, and sanctifying by such discipline both pain and fear until we recognize a grandeur in the beatings of the heart. Nor was this fellowship vouchsafed to me with stinted kindness in November days, when vapors rolling down the valley made a lonely scene more lonesome among woods. At noon and mid the calm of summer nights, when by the margin of the trembling lake, beneath the gloomy hills homeward I went, in solitude such intercourse was mine. Mine was it in the fields both day and night, and by the waters all the summer long. Now I am going to read its paraphrase. O wisdom and spirit of the universe, you are as eternal as human thought. You turn matter into different forms and lend to these forms life and everlasting movement. It was not in vain that ever since upon yourself the task of ever establishing an intimate relationship between human passions in my soul and everlasting objects of nature, and not the temporary and vulgar creations of man. Thus, by such discipline, you refined elements of my feelings and of thought, and lent a sacred quality to both pain and fear, and finally led me recognize grandeur in the beatings of the human heart. Further, you never lacked in generosity in bestowing on one this companionship with open heart. Hence, I could commune with nature in November, when clouds rolling down in the valley made the lonely valley more lonely, in the woods at noon as well as during the calm and quiet period of summer nights, when I used to go homewards along the bank of the quivering lake. I could also enjoy such companionship in the open fields both day by day and night, and all through summer season by the side of lakes and rivers. Now, line number 425 to 463. Text: And in the frosty season, when the sun was set and visible for many a mile, the cottage windows blazed through twilight gloom, I heeded not their summons happy time. It was indeed for all of us, for me, it was a time of rapture clear and loud. The village clock told six, I wheeled about, proud and exulting like an untired horse that cares not for his home, and sawed with till we hissed along the polished ice in games, comforted, imitative of the chase. And woodland pleasures, the resounding horn, and pack loud chiming and haunted hair. So through the darkness and the cold we flew, and not a voice was idle with a din. Smitten the precipices rang aloud, the leafless trees and every icy crack twinkled like iron, while far distant hills into the tumult sent an alien sound of melancholy not unnoticed, while the stars eastward were sparkling clear, and in the west the orange sky of evening died away. Not seldom from the uproar I retired into a silent boy, or sportively glanced sad way, leaving the tumultuous throng to cut across the reflex of a star that fled and flying still before me gleamed upon the grassy plain and oftentimes when we had given out bodies to the vine and all the shadowy banks on either side came sweeping through the darkness, spinning still the rapid lines of motion, then at once, how I reclining back upon my hills, stopped thought, yet still the solitary cliffs, wheeled by me, even as if the earth had rolled with visible motion her diurnal round. Behind me did they stretch in solemn train, feebler and feebler, and I stood and watched. Still all was tranquil as a dreamless sleep. 425 to 463. After the sunset, the cottage fire shining brightly through the twilight gloom were visible from miles away. I paid little attention to their call for returning home. It was indeed a very gay time for all of us, but for me it was a time of ecstatic delight. The village clock struck the hour at a sense of great pride and joy, like a horse which is still not tried and does not care to return home in the least. With metal skates tied to our feet, we moved on the smooth ice, producing hissing sounds. We wanted to enjoy all woodlands, pleasures, the games of the hunters with their pack of hounds, and resounding hunts to enjoy the thrill of chasing hares. Thus we skated over the ice and moved swiftly through the cold and darkness, all of us sounding collectively. The steepy mountains resounded with the noise of striking sounds of our sketching. The leafless trees and ice-capped hills made a soft ringing and metallic sound, while the far distant hills resounded melancholy sounds to mingle with all this great noise. This could not remain unnoticed by us. The stars were seen sparkling in the eastern sky at this time, while the orange color of the western sky faded away, leaving no stress. Often I used to retire from this noisy scene to some silent bay, or I would sometimes leave the noisy crowd, look sideways to chase the reflection of a star in the ice, the reflection that seemed to flee before me, but shining clearly on the mirror like surface of its plane. Many times when we moved in the direction in which the wind was blowing, the dark hillsides on either side appeared to be moving rapidly through the darkness. At such times, after going round and round in circles, I would abruptly stop. Reclinements and lonely rocks still seemed to be turning round, and this earth itself seemed to be revolving on its axis with distinct motion to complete its daily rotation. Gradually, these rocks, which seemed to lie stretched out behind me in a solemn procession, became slower in a moment, and I noticed everything absolutely as quiet and peaceful as a profound sleep not disturbed my dreams. Now, line number 464 to 475. Ye presence of nature in the sky and on the earth, ye visions of the hills and souls of lonely places, can I think a vulgar hope was yours when ye employed such ministry, when we through many a year hunting me thus among my boyish sports, on caves and trees, upon the woods and hills, impressed upon all forms the characters of danger or desire, and thus did make the surface of the universal earth with triumph and delight, with hope and fear, works like a sea. Not uselessly employed, might I pursue this theme through every change of exercise and play to which the year did summon us in his delightful round. O spiritual forces of nature in the sky and on the earth, O viscounts of the hills, souls of solitary places, it was with some noble hope, not a vulgar one, that you were actuated to adopt such training and discipline for my mind, when for a number of years you hunted me like this in the midst way of my boy sports in the caves, woods and on trees, making all objects of nature seem either dangerous or loving. Thus you made entire nature heave with triumphs and delight, with hope and fear as is seen on the vast surface of the sea.